This is a production of Cornell University.
First, please allow me to acknowledge and thank our donors, Barbara and David Zelaznik, who, through their generosity, have so enriched our lives here in Goldwin Smith Hall. And my colleagues in the Creative Writing Program, whose hard work and vision have made and continue to make this series and the program here at Cornell such a success. Thank you, Sarah and Marianne, for everything that you do. Thank you, Cynthia, for forsaking the Arizona sunshine to be with us this semester. And finally, thank all of you for braving the snow and cold this afternoon for the sake of poetry to listen. In Scheming Women, Poetry, Privilege, and the Politics of Subjectivity, Cynthia Hoag writes, empowerment evolves through exchange based on listening to, not talking at, a disengagement from the structures of dominance. Listening is not passive, but actively builds bridges between subjects positioned by, as well as shifting between internal and external differences, whether we define them as natural or constructed, whether established through the processes of inclusion / exclusion or identification / abjection. Cynthia Hoag's poetry makes evident her interest in dynamic exchange, in the work of the poet as active listener. Again and again, this idea emerges in Hoag's work. One finds it, for example, in the contrapuntal 2008 section of Arseniad, which Cynthia told me she's going to read this afternoon. I'm really glad of that. In the collection or consequence, with its magnificent uses of line and space. If she is not at the center, it is not her story. I speak to the margins instead of the center. Makes no difference. She's not there, here. Or in poems on New Orleans, a place Hoag notes where all the muses had streets. The interview poems in When the Water Came, evacuees of Hurricane Katrina, are drawn from actual words of evacuees, those from the Katrina diaspora who landed in Arizona. Their original interviews, some 50 pages long, shaped and edited with nothing added. As highlighted in the author's note, they stand with the book's photographs as, quote, individual facets of a larger mosaic. Together, they begin a conversation. In an interview with Poetry International, speaking of translation work, in which poems, quote, overflowed their original borders into another language, Hoag notes, a poem from any language translated into English freshens the language by estranging it from us. In the process, remaking our relationship to English and how we use it, or how language uses us. The act of translation must, by necessity, be a vigilant and hyper-aware process at every level of the poem, both in the original and the target language. But the generic nature of the poem is that, as it eludes control, it sharpens the tool, which I take to mean our usage of language. I'm interested very much in the way that Cynthia Hoag embodies that process, as in At Delphi, from the collection The Incognito Body, where she writes, the story is the path or way. We happen upon it once or twice, arrive in the lucid noon to a place where we once came to know what we do not know. My body knew, still, it felt like a feeling. I called it a feeling. Cynthia Hoag is the distinguished visiting writer of the Department of English for the spring 2014 semester. She's published 12 books, including Or Consequence and When the Water Came, Evacuees of Hurricane Katrina, interview poems with photographs by Rebecca Ross. She also co-translated for Tina Samano, I don't know if I'm saying that right, The Overflowing of the Poem, with Virginie Lalouch and Jean-Luc Nancy, winners of the 2013 Harold Morton Landon Translation Award from the Academy of American Poets. Her forthcoming collection is called Revenants, and it's due in the fall of 2014. She is the Maxine and Jonathan Marshall Chair of Modern and Contemporary Poetry at Arizona State University. Please welcome Cynthia Hogue.
Yes, do you hear me okay? Because I want you to hear that I am thanking you for what a generous introduction. Thank you, Lyra. And also for this welcome to be among you this semester is such an honor. And I've been really jazzed working with the students so far. Trust that's going to continue. It's a great conversation. I wanted to open with an homage to James McConkie, who I see is here. I was so moved by your reading, and I thought I would open with a poem that kind of functions as an homage. It's not a personal lyric. It's not straight autobiography, and yet it's all true. It happened. Once I removed it from the originating context, which was lunch, a lunch date, it became a fable. It's called Stones, and it has an epigraph from George Oppen. The universe is stone, but we are not. I have a friend who imprisons stones. How do you do that, I ask. I build little cages and put them in. And why do you imprison these stones? They are immoral stones. I oversee the purification of petrified beings. Where do you find these immoral stones? I find them in the river, which is low, in the summer drought. Are all the stones you see immoral? No, only the ones I imprison. Can you tell which stones are immoral? Yes, I can tell which ones are immoral and which are not. And where do you keep the cages? I keep them on a shelf near the window. And do you keep them by the window so they see their old abode and know what they have lost? I keep them by the window because that is where I have room. Will you free these stones? Yes, when they have learned morality and are purified of being petrified. Will you teach them morality and courage? No, morality and courage cannot be taught, but they can be learned. How will imprisoned stones learn? They will learn because I have moved them, and that is what they feared most. When will they know they have learned? I will know when they know. Actual conversation didn't seem strange at the time. But when I got home and wrote it down, I thought, I think this is a poem. I wanted to open with a couple of other poems that work with voice. This began as a classroom assignment, as so often we writing teachers discover that if we do the assignments that we actually give, we sometimes get a poem, not always, but sometimes. So I was giving a writing intensive on Cape Cod, and we went over some conversation poems, and I assigned a conversation poem, and that afternoon was privy to this conversation on Bumps River. This has a little bit more commentary than the first. We have come with kayaks to the water, powder blue and marine blue, framed by dune, barrier island, the steely clouds. One of us says, I'm afraid. The second, take risks, face fears. The third, holding his child, place feet near center to stay balanced, upright. I go in circles, 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 the first says, though I wish to cut the water like wings slice air. Wind rises and the child is cold. I'm cold, he says, I'm cold. As ospreys hover, dives, touches the water and rises, flapping, lifting, the fish in his talons, waiting him. The third says, the law of aerodynamics are illustrated by the osprey, which, flying as he descends, plucks the fish and turns it with his talons to face the direction in which he flies. We all look up again at the osprey, flying low over the dune, still visible. The second says, poor fish. The third, the osprey nests near others because it hunts alone. The wind's rising. The child's cold. The first says, we will go back. The second, we will go on a while. The fish is sailing out of sight and does not think or move and will not close its eyes. This next poem is a recounting of a conversation. It's about a conversation to which I was not privy and probably wouldn't have understood if I had been there. But this is from Revenants, the forthcoming book, which is a very placed book. Many of my poems are placed, but this is in the eco-poetic sense of the spirit of a place, or even the spirit of another species with which or with whom we might commune if we are deeply enough engaged with the place. The woman who talked with trees. That a tree could speak. That a woman claiming to converse with and to tell the story of trees in a novel she hides in her desk, so careful to talk about, but otherwise to keep tree speech to herself, walked into a stand of vernal elm, endangered oak, and spoke to you, and you listened to her. In that grove, those trees now conjured that words could keep them. So I think about voices, I listen, as Lyra so beautifully explained. It's a practice called attentive listening that I was doing long before I trained in conflict transformation, but became a way to understand human nature, what we reveal and what we conceal, of course, in what we say. But this next poem, the Arsiniad, which is from a longer series called Ars Cora, is very much asking the question, how does one listen if the voice has been silenced? How does one tell a story that has disappeared from history? If the only sign that somebody lived is her name in a court document about her case. So this poem is trying to access the spirit of this personage about whom I was told the month before I was leaving New Orleans for good, Cora Arsine. She was not the first slave to use the courts to sue for her freedom, but she had the unique distinction of being the last. On the eve of the Fugitive Slave Act, which closed the courts to slaves suing for manumission, she started her lawsuit in the same year as Dred Scott. As we know, his case went on to the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court. Cora Arcine actually won. She sued her owners, who had taken her to France. That's roughly the outline of the story. They took her to France, where basically, because French law forbade slavery, she was freed. And when they brought her back to New Orleans and tried to re-enslave her, she sued them, both for her freedom and also for her back wages. This was a story that I took 10 years to research. Didn't know much about slave history. I didn't know much. I'm not a Southerner. I didn't know much about Southern history. I didn't know about the Caribbean history of slave rebellions. And I researched for 10 years to contextualize this person. I kept trying to give the story away. Nobody picked it up. And finally, a friend said, you know, I think it's your story. Find a way to tell it. It's fractured. Part of the story is my search, my journey, but I want it to be very much in the margins of this poem. Arcinia, there are two epigraphs. If history is a record of survivors, poetry shelters other voices. Susan Howe. She isn't here, nor her page of exertion. Kathleen Frazier. 1836. An owned person leaving New Orleans. Few paved roads or lights. Levees lined with a forest of masts. No other city of the world had advanced with such gigantic, burgeoning on the bayou. Eric Fleury, easy mobility on waterways, pervasive swamps to escape enslavement and survive. Chaotic, prevailing, mixing. Indian, African, Spanish, then French, after which American rule erased. The Côte Noir and Las Partitas Sieta, which defined its bondsmen and bondswomen. By legal definition, slaves had souls, and therefore, productivity encouraged manumission, illegal, barbarous, and inhuman treatment. Eugene Genovese Roll Jordan, not to be confused with actual kindliness, no fabled golden age of good, always only goods. Arcine, alias Cora. One thing I should mention is that the court documents consistently refer to Cora Arcine as Arcine, alias Cora. So you'll hear that again in the poem. Arcine, alias Cora, traveled to New York with the white Creole couple who owned her. Own, adjective, intensifier, as in to thine own self be, and verb, to possess, used with object, as in to own something, or this case, someone. And verb, to acknowledge, as in to own a fault. All three boarded a schooner for a sojourn in France. Arcine, alias Cora, walked off the ship where tout individu est libre aussitôt qu'il est en France, and was, by French law, freed. 1838. In Paris, a distinct effort of the imagination is required to visualize cobbled streets and begrimed spires that horse-drawn along river to place of concord, arc of triumph, at Etoile, around which still woods, the mentality of liberty, free passage all over, every body, self-evident, enlightenment, post-revolution, and idealized thought that Corrid have heard. Learned letters, one at least survives by account in court documents, A, on a note she handed one of her witnesses. Returned with her owner, was, before France, a good servant, after sojourn, impertinent and insolent, irrevocably obdurate, are seen alias Cora when re-enslaved 8 years later, put up for sale, herself refused to comply. 1846, became the last slave to, hired the best lawyer who would take such cases. Oh, use the courts. Oh, sued for freedom. Plaintiff gave witness on her behalf, J. Ducournau, small piece of paper marked with the letter A. Two or three front teeth are missing. Are seen alias Cora, a name in census rolls in New Orleans and a Supreme Court of Louisiana decision, also appeals, wherein both courts ruled, cannot affect and destroy the donation of the freedom made in France by the consent of the master. No law can be enforced retroactively. It can only be made for the future. 2008. I am speaking of her. I write in silence. My words cannot find her or become her. If she is not at the center, it is not her story. I speak to the margins instead of the center. It makes no difference. She's not there. So, it's a bit of documentary. I read about half of it. A bit of documentary method to try to excavate, to try to piece together that which had simply vanished. I would call it a kind of poetics of witness, or at least written in that spirit. My husband and I thought that we would read a little bit from the translation for Tino Simano, and he will read the French, so that you get a sense of the original. What this book is it's a collaboration between the young experimental poet Virginie Lanuc and the French philosopher of aesthetics, Jean-Luc Nancy, who really admired her work. And when he saw that when he heard that she was doing the series on Fortino Simano, he asked if he might write a kind of commentary, an explication of the text. Her series is about not the Mexican revolutionary and Zapatista lieutenant Fortino Simano, but about a photograph. We had thought it was the only extant photograph, but we were just corrected that there is in fact one other photograph. But the photograph that Virginie Lanuc meditates on is snapped by Augustin Victor Casasola, documentary photographer of the Mexican Revolution, the moment before Fortino Simano is to be executed, which you would never know from the photograph. He's very nonchalant, he's smoking a cigar, he's looking death he's in fact looking at the firing squad with the sense of sang-froid. And that's where she begins her meditation. The first two that we're going to read, she resuscitates her voice, she inhabits him. And Jean-Luc Nancy's commentary is really on the nature of the poetic image. There's no reproduction of the photograph. The only reproduction is poetic. So what Virginie Lalouque is contemplating what the photographic image, what the visual image can do. And Jean-Luc Nancy is contemplating what happens in the transmission, the translation into poetry. So this is very much a work of aesthetics. By the way, I'm so sorry, my husband.
Okay.
Perhaps you figured that out.
I'm just the husband, okay. Combien mes bourreaux étaient-ils charmants? L'image ne dit rien du règlement de compte central, de la fusillade et du léger liséré de sang qui s'ensuivra. Pourtant, pour l'instant, je souris. Pour l'instant, mon casier judiciaire se vide et encore sans lasso. Quelle image? A-t-on vu une image? Virginie m'a dit qu'il n'y aurait pas dans son livre la photographie de Fortino Samano devant son peloton d'exécution. Je n'aurais donc pas vu d'image. Or, elle ne dit rien. Je m'avise que cela se dit dans un alexandrin. L'image ne dit rien du règlement de compte. Tout de suite, déjà, le vers cardinal du poème français, ce n'est pas un hasard. C'est pourquoi la coupe suivante dit lapidairement « centrale ». L'image ne dit rien. Or, l'image est par excellence qualité poétique. L'image, c'est le poème. L'image absente, c'est le poème qui fait image en parlant ainsi, léger, liséré de sang, se voit en se lisant, en se disant, se voit littéralement allitéré dans un filet rouge, soigneusement brodé. Virginie choisit l'orthographe avec deux accents aigus plutôt que liséré pour insister sur la minceur figée du filet carmin qui s'ensuivra, juste avant qu'il soit versé. Pour l'instant, je souris, pour l'instant. Je souris maintenant en vue de cet instant. Je souris à l'instant et pour qu'il reste cet instant. Je souris à son éternel retour. Un sourire à la mort légère, qui ne dure qu'un instant. Un sourire à l'immobilité du moment où ça verse, le sens suspendu dans une imminence qui restera imminente. Le sens n'aura pas lieu. L'image ne dit rien. Voilà le poème sur le bord, en lisière, en liséré. Et cela ne fait pas un lasso, pas une boucle qui entrave, pas plus que Fortino n'est attaché devant ses fusilleurs. Son sang et ses manquements à la loi se vident librement. Pourtant, je ne peux pas ne pas entendre comment le sang se reprend dans le sang lasso. Le filet carmin fait aussi boucle où se prend le sens ainsi captif de l'instant qui n'aboutira jamais.
How many of my executioners were charming? The image tells us nothing about settling scores central to this shooting, or of the light brim of blood that follows. At the moment, I'm smiling. At the moment, my criminal record empties, and there's no lasso yet. What image? Did anyone see an image? Virginie told me there won't be a photograph in her book of Fortino Samano in front of the firing squad. Then I won't have seen an image. But it says nothing. I notice that this is set in an Alexandrine. The image tells us nothing about settling scores. Right away, already the cardinal line of French poetry. It is not by accident. It is why the cut that follows says concisely, central. The image says nothing, but the image has par excellence a quality of the poetic. The image is the poem. Absent the image, the poem will make an image in speaking. Just as light brim of blood is seen when read, when said to oneself, seen literally alliterated in the carefully elaborated welling of red. Virginie chooses wording that doubles blood's plosive, insisting on the coagulating carmine trickle to follow. Just before it is to spill, at the moment, I'm smiling, at the moment. I smile now, having this moment in mind. I smile at this moment so that it will remain this moment. I smile thinking of its eternal return, a smile for an easy death lasting only an instant, a smile for the stillness of the moment before it spills, the meaning suspended in an imminence which remains imminent. The meaning never occurs. The image says nothing. Here's the poem, on the ridge, the edge, on the brim. This does not make a lasso, not a loop that would fetter any more than Fortino is tied in front of his killers. His blood and his crimes empty out freely. But I cannot not hear how the blood is caught by this no lasso. The trickle of carmine makes a loop where meaning is captured by a moment that will never come to anything.
Si l'exécution fut sommaire ou non, le mur a des allures de figurant derrière, au premier plan. L'image n'est pas un stéthoscope, pas plus que je ne suis un héros ou un acteur de cinéma. L'image ne dit pas si mon rythme cardiaque s'accélérera à cet instant précis. Je souris largement, je suis fort, je suis le pire salaud qui soit. Je me fusille, je fume mon dernier cigare, après quoi me relève et vous souris encore. Il est mort, il se relève ressuscité si l'on veut, ou bien imagé pleinement, passé dans ce silence de l'image sans cœur qui bat et sans déclaration sur celui qui parle, sinon qu'il parle et qu'il prononce cet instant précis où il tombe et se relève, comme un verre, de nouveau chute, coupe et revers. L'exécution, tout est là, la mise en œuvre, la réalisation menée à terme. C'est pourquoi ce bloc est ouvert par un décasyllabe très cadencé avec rime interne à l'hémistiche, si l'exécution fut sommaire ou non. Il y a dans le vers une exécution toujours en quelque sorte sommaire du cours du sens, du discours qui ne se tient pas à l'instant. La coupe du cours, au contraire, n'a lieu qu'à l'instant précis. Le sens s'y fusille lui-même. Quel mot glacé, crépitant, sans appel. Et la fumée du cigare, ici, qui monte encore mêlée à celle des fusils. Un poème est toujours, à chaque instant, un dernier mot sans conclusion.
Whether the execution was summary or not, the walls an alluring extra in the background. In the foreground, the image is not a stethoscope any more than I am a hero or movie actor. The image does not say whether my heartbeat speeds up. At this very instant, I'm grinning wide. I'm strong. I'm the worst son of a bitch alive. I'll shoot myself, smoke my last cigar, after which I'll rise to grin at you again. He's dead. He gets up, resuscitated, if you like, or fully imagined, passing into the silence of this image with no beating heart, without clarifying who is speaking, except that someone is speaking. Someone announces the exact moment that he falls and gets up. Like a line, anew, falling, cutting, reversing. The execution, everything is there, set into play, brought to term. That is why the verse opens with such a cadence, decasyllable, and internal rhyme in the hemistich. Whether the execution was summary or not. There is in the line an execution that is always in some sense summary, of the course of meaning, of discourse that does not relate to the moment. The break in that course, in contrast, must take place only at the precise moment meaning shoots itself. What a cold word, sputtering without appeal. And the rising smoke from the cigar here mixes with the smoke from the guns. A poem is always, at each moment, a last word with no conclusion.
Thank you.
And I'm going to read two more poems. One is ekphrastic, and it is a poem without conclusion. It is also a poem very much in conversation with the economy. Sylvain is an economist, as well as my co-translator. And what I can say since we married is that I think a whole lot more about the economy than I otherwise would have, although I don't think about it in the same way. On securities and exchange, this is really, in some sense, an ars poetica as well. On securities and exchange, a river runs through the painting. Its blue wash sweeps across the whole foreground. It narrows, meanders into the canyon. Its currents are the same sky blue as the triangle of sky, and the sun casts a bright strip edged in beryl through hills hulking into hunter green. You no longer feel safe in the country, which has exchanged safety, securities, for insecurities. Such pressing matters distract you from painting. Art's abstraction of what's real, its refusal to face facts like everyone else, or this is the thing, its complication of what is what confuses you. Does the river flow towards you or away? You spend all day not deciding. And I'll close. I wanted to share with you part of the I would say the emotion for me of being here is that I grew up not so far from here, and I have spent the last 3 years shuttling back and forth between Arizona and the Saratoga area for elder care, and that care came to completion last summer. My mother died. My father died 2 years ago. So in the month I've been here, I have been working on a piece that I started earlier. But this has to do with being dislocated. I am certainly, although I know this region, I am certainly in culture shock. We drove 2,500 miles through a blizzard system that seemed to just miss us, but certainly accompany us for all of those miles. I didn't remember winter being so dramatic. I remember things like tobogganing. but I'm going to read you just this piece of what is a longer elegiac meditation, and it's about being a voyager with a nod to Ezra Pound, the wayfarer. Of course, the wayfarer in my poem is female. You must turn your thoughts to the displacement of a voyage. Cultivate the mind to undertake travel's long discomfort and insecurity, such as tripping downstairs as you start. Dust yourself off, feel for broken bones, forget pride, and adapt the parlance of malediction and misunderstanding for the rare day that all goes well, to consider the way of the wayfarer. You won't think of it at the time, but later, after the black eye shows from the fall, the cramp flares in your hip as you step onto the overlook. You find luck on the road in February. The sheer pluck you chose to tarry where others find bone-chilling wind. When asked, were you born happy? You say, no, I was not. Rather, and persistently melancholic. Yet the treasure of your get up and go, your grit in the not giving up, tempers the story you always tell. And I have to mention here that this is not autobiographical. This actually is my mom. Yet the treasure of your get up and go, your grit in the not giving up, tempers the story you always tell. For a lark, really. Maybe to be funny. Or a bit magical. Who knows? The one with fairies at the bottom of the garden in the song that broke you up every time. It's so silly that you could never finish. Thank you so much. Thank you. Any questions? I'm happy to answer questions. I'm also happy to stand here while you're silent. thinking about whether you have any questions. Roger.
You spoke in the next to last poem you read, you spoke about art's refusal to face facts, and yet you, a lot of your poems seem to precisely be, you know, kind of dealing with facts, with documentary material or translation, photographic, you know, records. Did you have a way of thinking about how poetry deals with factual material like that, document?
Yes, yes, absolutely. That's such a great question, because the conversation that I was having in my head writing the ekphrastic poem was very much with the world beyond arts and humanities, right, where art is not valued and is considered, if not valueless, somewhat of an inscrutable mode of communication. So that was the context for that. But art, of course, is facing facts in ways that transform the facts, that ways that make us aware, ways that bring these facts into a different attention, like that conversation I had over lunch, which at the time was just weirdly playful, and I played along. And you know what came up when you isolate it is something that has really been transformed out of context, thanks to the process of decontextualization. Robert Duncan talked about, he was trying to get Denise Levertov, his friend, to stop writing a documentary poetic during the Vietnam War. And he said, you know, you how can I convey to you the importance of transforming this material, that you have to alchemize the material through word work? And her point was that through recontextualizing the facts, through enhancing them by giving them the artistic frame or the formalization of the being in the work of art, that's part of that alchemization. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Yes.
I was wondering how you think about the oral performance of a poem like the Arseniad, which on the page has all sorts of typographical features that you can't reproduce, such as crossed out words,
yes,
spacings, etc. Do you think of these as just two completely different things, or is one an inferior rendition of the other? Is the real poem on the page, or is the real poem your performance? Or how do you think about those two?
Well, it's, you know, the Arseniad is not a performance poem per se. It's not that I haven't read it, but I don't read it very often because it is hard to perform. And some things like the white Creole couple, white is in erasure, in visible erasure, and that's a kind of acknowledgement of the nuances of race in New Orleans, in and around New Orleans, which, you know, I could do something like that, but I'm not a dancer, I'm not a performer per se. I am performing, but I would say that they are in tandem, right? That the work shifts when you hear it orally, and it shifts again when you sit with it on the page. I left out some of the most documentary passages simply because they don't perform as well, really. Yeah. Thank you.
I've been thinking ever since my seminar about Robert Duncan and Denise Levertov, and just how much of a drama their letters have come to be in American poetics. for instance, you were to partake in a kind of conflict mediation between those two poets, you know, or engage back with them, how, you know, because they're such that, like you were saying, there's such a stark break between them, and they seem so unreconcilable at the end.
They were, yeah, they were finally. If I were to be a mediator for Denise Levertov and Robert Duncan, one of the things that became very clear when I was reviewing that material, I was kind of theorizing her poetics of witness as a kind of eyewitness, and I italicized eyewitness. But she tried very hard. She listened very hard. And Duncan was very, very caring. He was very, very gentle with her. For a long time, there was real communication. And then finally, feelings got hurt, and egos got bruised. And sometimes it's most productive. It's been very productive for American poetry that they had that fight and that it was long distance because we have all of the letters that are such a rich source about process and about poetics. For them, it was, they were actually, he did try to apologize. And she finally refused to accept the apology. But for American, you know, for them personally, it was a real shame. But for American poetry, it was very productive. And that's what they say about conflict, is it's often productive. The communication is amplified, if you will. I think a lot of interesting poetry, Duncan wrote poetry, she wrote poetry, very much in conversation with each other, really. It was really about something I've also thought a lot about, how to be a poet during wartime. How to be a poet when the country is waging a war that is distant and does not impact, you know, me personally. I'm afraid my voice is going to give out, so thank you so much.
This has been a production of Cornell University on the web at cornell.edu.